Welcome back to another episode of Science Nights.
Hello.
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 Hello. Tonight we are talking about astronomy. Astrophysics and cosmology, I believe, is the title of the episode.
Broad subject.
It is. That's kind of the point of this episode, just to go over some broad definitions, a little bit of history real quick of the stars.
The universe and everything, because
pretty much
apparently this is everything.
Yeah.
As always, I'm Josh. That's Sir Peter.
Sir Peter,
and
with
I'm Adam.
Finger in his face.
And that's Maester Adam over there. He's forging his producer chain today. I don't even watch it.
You do watch it. You just haven't watched all of it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
But yeah. I wouldn't mind being a Maester. Could have my astronomy chain right now.
Yeah, but you got to be celibate.
I don't know. All the crap he had to go through.
Literal
crap. Yeah, like literal.
I don't know if I would do it.
I guess to start off, what is astronomy? What is astrophysics? And what is cosmology?
So basically, astronomy can kind of umbrella the whole term, but for the most part, it's the observation of stars. The movement of stars and planets and other celestial bodies and things like that. Whereas astrophysics is more the measurement of stars.
Like how big they are, how overweight they are?
How big they are, the mass, how far away they are, how they're going to move, things like that.
The effects of their gravity and the gravity around them? Is
correct.
That astrophysics?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Is astrophysics also the study of other celestial bodies, not just planets?
Yes.
Yes.
So,
yes.
Like, if we're talking about, like, the Oort cloud, that would be astrophysics?
Mm-hmm. Pretty much all astronomy, or mm-hmm. all celestial bodies, anything.
Quasars, black holes.
Yeah.
And absolutely. Going from the most broadest sense, could any science be labeled as astrophysics? Like, as broad, like talking about the chemistry of stuff on another planet, would that still be astrophysics?
It could, right? Because if we found life on another planet, I mean, we would be more, there would be like astrobiology and stuff like that, but we would be looking at it from that perspective. Whereas a lot of the problem comes from us thinking about Earth as something separate from space, when really we're just a part of the whole system as it is, you know?
Okay, astrophysics, the word is just for us. It's really just physics in the universe.
It is, yeah.
It is.
All of these words are just for us. I mean, nature doesn't really have any defining lines. We're the ones that put the defining lines there, so there's no natural separation between this. This is just words for us.
But I think that the subtending branches of astrophysics, like astrobiology, those are... I put a different viewpoint on a traditional science. Because with astrobiology, you're trying to look for biology that is not from Earth. Like you're trying to find something that's so outside of our understanding of current biology, because our biology is just our biology. It comes from Earth, and there's no way to look beyond that. So, I mean, we're kind of creating all these new branches. Yeah, delineations. Yeah, that's
like
a good
it.
Word for it.
I like it. I'm just trying to contextualize it. Like,
yeah,
the prefix astro just refers to everything outside of Earth. I'm pretty sure that's where we're going with this, right?
For the most part, yeah.
Yeah.
If we're mm-hmm. if we're going very broad,
yeah.
And then cosmology. That sounds like someone who's going to cut my hair. But that's cosmetology. So that's the science of cosmetics, and you need to not study that.
Well, hey. There's a lot of people employed.
I look
fantastic, don't you? But that's like the origin of the universe.
Yeah, cosmology deals more with the big picture. So like right now I have a picture of the Big Bang,
Where'd they get it? Where'd they get that photo and who took it?
But cosmology deals with like the origin, how the universe evolved, and then the eventual fate of the universe.
Yeah.
So like... when we deal with heat death and everything just kind of being nothing again.
This does kind of reach towards cosmology. It does kind of reach towards more natural philosophy, in the sense that the theories, though based in mathematics, still are not observed.
Right.
Like it's, well, like well, like Omega, the expansion of the universe, that can be observed. But like the Big Bang, we have information like the cosmic background radiation is all pointing towards the origin of the universe. But the thought experiments used to like bring up the Big Bang, like that's all unproven.
It's all theory.
Yeah, yeah, it's
right.
It's definitely a different realm of thought science. So.
Is that the correct way to describe it? As theory, because it's not a scientific theory. We can't. We haven't had evidence to prove it, other than observable evidence.
Well, they would be.
I guess it's the Big Bang theory. So yeah.
It's there are tertiary pieces of information that support the Big Bang theory.
Yeah.
It's right. Just there isn't any way to directly observe that kind of behavior. So.
Right.
We don't have any experiments. We don't have any way of like. Well, let's go ahead and test the Big Bang.
But it is still.
That's not a bad idea.
Let's bottle it.
But there is still experiments conducted to try to understand it.
Absolutely.
And, there is a lot of peer review there. So it's still a theory, even though it's maybe not as, you know, it's not as proven of a theory like general relativity or something
sure.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
But
man, are we ever going to tackle general relativity?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Right after we discuss all of Newton's stuff, I feel like it's the next best step.
I do like that for our second episode, we're just going like the most broad that you can ever go.
That would be so that would be astronomy. Astrophysics is the mechanics of it, and cosmology is the whole big picture. One thing I did want to note is, let's see, let me change the picture on here. Astrology.
Yeah. they got the better name.
That,
unfortunately.
I'm a Virgo right here.
Leo.
I'm a Taurus.
Oh, you're a lion. What are you?
I'm a Taurus.
I am
you're
not lying to you.
You're a lion. Roar. Are you like, is it like Katy Perry? Am I going to hear you roar?
No. No, you're not.
You know, I heard that Leos are very headstrong and that Tauruses are like an immovable object. Especially on
today. Thank you for highlighting why this is all bullshit.
when Venus is in reaction to Mars on exactly 3:31 and 45 seconds, you guys tend to be agreeable to what I'm saying now.
No.
So our reason for bringing this up is
sorry.
To illustrate that, right?
Well, I figure, you know, absurdist is fun, right?
Right, exactly. That's why so many people enjoy astrology, even though there's no basis in science.
Yeah, but it's actually, astronomy should be called astrology.
Right.
Yes.
Astronomy, or astrology, like, literally translates to study of the stars.
Yeah, but the modern and the colloquial interpretation of astrology is going off of your birth sign, or it's literally a pseudoscience.
Right.
When you were born, what position the stars were in when you were born, and their relationship with the day that it is now has some bearing on your future or
and your
present,
behavior
and your behavior.
Right. Your
and,
diet, your
and how planets align and stuff like that.
But we should say that the study of astrology did lead to our understanding of astronomy now.
Oh,
like, without that there wouldn't be this. But we have to take all of the meaning of astrology, like if I saw a comment that there's going to be a great war, that is all out the window. Like there isn't any, as far as we know, meaning between the two things.
Man, I would love to dig into like the falsehoods or the things to look out for in astrology if we ever get a chance.
Like, let's go like over all pseudosciences.
That'd be great too.
Yeah, we should at some point.
I like the idea of like you said, like a comet is the harbinger of a war or a famine or
something bad,
or it could be something good too. There were ancient civilizations that were like, oh, we're gonna have great prosperous crops, or the gods are smiling on us. Look, they sent a tail.
Yeah. Well, I mean, astrology goes even deeper than that. Now, at least. It's in all of our newspapers. It's in writing, like in Game of Thrones, the comet the birth of the prince that was promised.
Right.
Like these are all elements of astrology that have gotten to popular culture. And now a lot of people may read their horoscopes in the newspaper and not connect the two things and not connect the history of that thing to now.
Yeah.
But I feel like most people these days don't believe in astrology.
Fun farce.
Yeah, exactly, it's
right.
a fun farce.
Don't put too much. It's like a fortune cookie or something.
Yeah.
Right?
Fortune cookies have gone downhill.
Oh,
either I've aged up and I'm looking at them, I'm like, This is not even a fortune. No. This is just a statement.
This is just advice. I don't
exactly.
You should go on a walk today. I'm like, maybe I will, yeah.
Save money, live better. Walmart. What?
Well, they should start doing that. That's revenue stream for them.
All right. Well, let's move away from astrology.
Yeah.
We're going to go into history now, which I know tends to be Josh's favorite.
I love history.
Favorite part of these episodes.
So we're actually going to be starting as far forward as the Greek philosophers. But one thing I want to stress is that as far as the Western world is concerned, we're very late to the astronomy game.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually mostly the Middle East and I would say Babylon, Mesopotamia, Egypt. They were the ones to first start probing into the stars. Actually, the first telescopes come from the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
Camera obscura comes from the Middle East. And, you know, a lot of our main mathematics and all that stuff comes from, algebra today is named after a Middle Eastern language. So what I'm getting at is we would be a lot further in the Western world in our understanding of astronomy and cosmology and astrophysics. We would be much further if there wasn't this thing called the Dark Ages.
Yeah.
If the Crusades never happened, if religion and philosophy overtook enlightenment and skepticism, if there wasn't that level of control over the general populace until the Age of Enlightenment, we would be a lot further along. I know that's kind of a truism, but I think it's an important distinction that as advanced as we feel ourselves are in the West, our history is rife with we're stupid.
Yeah.
We're like the dumbest people.
Yeah, and most of those advancements that we're thinking about now are just a fraction of time.
And I just want to point out, though, that just not even just Christianity in the Dark Ages, if it weren't for the Ptolemies being wiped out in the Library of Alexandria be burned, then we'd be even further along than we are now.
Absolutely.
And there are so many, we like know of the titles of these lost books from the library, and like the names are tantalizing, but we have none of the information.
Right.
So, I mean, calculus may have even been rediscovered by Newton.
That's a good point.
With the amount that was lost, I mean, there's so much mathematics.
That's probably highly likely too, considering how much of our mathematics are based on Middle Eastern numbers and their workings. I would not be surprised, Pete. That's a good point.
So that set us back hundreds of years.
Yeah. We could be much further along now.
I was reading something about the Library of Alexandria. They always talk about like the time it burned down or got destroyed or whatever, but apparently it was most likely have gotten burned down quite often.
is what I was reading.
Well, that's the thing. Like, whenever a conqueror comes in, what do? They wipe out the history of the last one.
Which is so fucked up. So messed up.
Well, the Ptolemies apparently had a lot of... They were rife with a lot of unpopularity. They were very popular within Alexandria, but outside of Alexandria, their pursuit of knowledge was considered, like,
heresy.
Right.
And so, and his treatment of foreign dignitaries, apparently the Ptolemies were required to take the writings of other cultures when they visited Alexandria, copy them and then give them back.
Yeah.
So there was this kind of almost like you're stealing our lineage information kind of thing. And
yeah,
so
but that same society also sent out wanderers to come back with knowledge.
But exactly. I mean, it was unprecedented for the time.
Sure.
But
we're far afield.
Yeah, we are far afield.
So let's get back on.
Let's talk about this ancient Greek named Eratosthenes that was the ancient astrologer who first accurately measured the circumference of the earth. That's a fantastic feat, especially because he did it on foot.
He lived from 276 BCE to 194 BCE.
Yeah.
But didn't he accurately measure it using shadows?
Yes.
Sticks.
He measured it by the shadow looking down. He figured out that at a certain time at noon, if you look down the well, the sun was directly above it. Mm-hmm. So,
but then somewhere some number of miles away, that wasn't the case.
Right. Yep. So based on that, he figured out that it was. That section of Earth that he had measured was like 1/50th the circumference of the Earth.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So he just finished his equation.
Right. And apparently pretty accurate.
Very accurate. But I think that a lot of the inaccuracy comes with the units of measurement that he had access to at the time.
Was it hectares that he was using?
Well, units of measurement and that he assumed that the Earth was
flat.
A perfect circle.
Oh, that's
right.
He assumed it was a perfect sphere,
right.
Which it is not.
Yeah.
So it gets stretched by the sun's gravity.
Have you heard that adage that if you go microscopically on a cue ball and microscopically on the earth, or and then compare it to the different levels in the earth, that a cue ball is like 18,000 times more.
I've heard it as a bowling ball, but yes, I know what you're talking about. The earth is smoother than a bowling ball.
There we
ball
go. That's what I'm going for. Yeah.
Which is interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. So what about Hipparchus or Hipparchus?
Hold on, because one real quick thing I wanted to point out that kind of went with what we were talking about knowing things a long time ago and forgetting them, is on the Wikipedia page for...
Eratosthenes.
I don't know.
Yeah, Greek.
In the audiobook Cosmos, they say Eratosthenes. So, I mean, I'll go off that just because...
You know, if you read like the word Euripides, it does not look like it's spelled not sound like it's spelled. Or epitome. All those Greek names, screw them.
Yeah, it's a different language.
Yeah.
it points out in the Wikipedia that 700 years after his death, Christopher Columbus had been studying his measurements of the Earth, but decided that they were wrong. And that's why that's what ended up leading him to believe that it was India that he landed on instead of a new world.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
But and actually they talked about that in the Isaac Newton biography audiobook that I was talking about, that Christopher Columbus had shrunk his measurements mainly to make the voyage seem more appealing and less expensive.
To get funded.
Yeah, exactly. Like he lied about his math. Yeah. But only after it happened were they like, hey, this math is wrong. But, you know, what he wanted.
Who's Hipparchus?
So Hipparchus is considered the founder of trigonometry.
Okay. So he's that guy that I can blame for sophomore year. That was my trig class. So I understand that mathematics is the language of science, and without trigonometry we wouldn't have modern calculus, so I guess we can thank him for that. But he was also the one to discover the precession of the equinoxes,
right?
Yes,
gotcha.
Which is amazing, right? That's
for that time,
especially thinking that it's still BC, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I don't have his dates here, let me pull it up real quick.
And you know, the equinoxes are when the Earth is I can't remember exactly the definition of an equinox.
It's when if you think of the Earth's movement sinusoidally like a wave, the equinoxes would be the top and bottom part of the graph where one area of the Earth is facing towards the sun closer than the others.
Yeah, and I think the actual equinox is when the sun crosses the equator.
Yeah.
So,
but I'm
at the closest point.
Yeah. You know.
So his was 190 BCE to 120 BCE.
60 or 70. Wow.
Yeah.
That's long.
Lived a decent life. Trigonometry is very, very important to us to calculate like distances and find things. Mm-hmm. And so.
Yeah. Yeah, I just remember not liking it in school. Probably because just like any other high advanced mathematics class, the teacher was very dry.
There was a lot of things that I didn't like in school that I enjoy now.
Yeah, that I have the same.
One of them being history. I could not stand history in school.
I always loved history.
But without trigonometry, we wouldn't have flight. We wouldn't have advanced architecture. I mean, there's a lot that we wouldn't have without trigonometry. Vectors are very important for human life these days. So
and rocket launching.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then we're gonna jump ahead about, I don't know, 1,000 years or more.
Yeah.
1,200 years, 1,300
years, yeah. I think about
to a young gentleman, you may have heard of him, named Nicholas Copernicus. He was around during the Renaissance and Reformation era. And he's a mathematician and astronomer. He formulated the first working model of the universe with the sun at the center.
Heliocentric.
As opposed to geocentric.
Centric.
Right.
To use the Latin term.
Mm-hmm. even though his model was far more accurate than the geocentric model, we're still a long way at this point from having our understanding of the universe. Oh. Because his thought was that the universe was revolving around the sun, when in fact it was just our solar system among many other.
Yeah, right. He still thought we were galactic center.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is 15,000 light years somewhere else. So.
Yeah. We're just on this lonely arm of the Milky Way.
It takes a long time for people to think how unimportant we are. So
yeah,
we'll probably get into that after we're done with the history part of this episode.
Fun fact, he lived to 70 also.
Really?
Wow.
From 1473 to 1543.
There's a pattern here for geniuses.
They come in 70s. From there, we move on to, I would say, the David Bowie or Elton John of modern astronomy, one of the most influential and important people ever, Galileo Galilei. He's Italian.
Dope name.
And right?
That's a really cool name.
Hey, how much do you guys like your family? We're going to name our kids' first name after us. That's how much we like our family. He's a major role in the scientific revolution of the 17th century. His contributions to observational and the observation and analysis of sunspots and modern astronomy were incredible. A lot of people recognize him as just the guy who looked through the telescope and discovered Jupiter and its moons.
Right.
But he's more than that.
Absolutely. Yeah, far more than that.
Another reason why he's so iconic in the world of science and the scientific revolution is because of the problems that happened with the Roman and Catholic Inquisition surrounding his theories and stuff. He was considered a heretic. First of all, for not only for backing up Copernicus's theory of a heliocentric solar system, but also to say that the Earth was not, like, divinely made.
Yeah.
Right.
Let's see. He was eventually criticized as foolish and absurd in philosophy and formally heretical since it explicitly contradicts in many places the sense of Holy Scripture. He was tried by the Inquisition and found vehemently suspect of heresy and forced to recant. He spent the rest of his life under house arrest.
Shit.
So that harkens back to what we said before we started the history segment of this.
We're stupid.
Yeah, we are some of the dumbest people on the planet. On the planet.
I mean, we're the only people on the planet, but we are dumb.
Yeah, I was more thinking like Western white people. I really do. I really think that we're some of the most egotistical and maniacal people on this planet, and our history shows that.
I think that history is even. It goes all directions. It's not just the Western society.
Yeah, I agree with that too. I think just humans in general
suck.
Are that way.
I feel like Western society specifically for the sciences, we were very stupid in what we chose to suppress.
Yeah.
And I mean, that goes.
It seems to be getting worse.
Yeah.
Right? With the freedom of information that is out there now, it still seems like we're making science not important. It's like even more so than we did 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's not even. I mean, even back then, scientists would suppress information. So after the Pythagoreans discovered that there were irrational numbers, his followers, after he died, actually suppressed the information of irrational numbers because it didn't fit within their philosophy of the world. They thought that all numbers could be expressed as integer ratios, everything in the whole universe.
Until then irrational and imaginary numbers started coming around.
Yeah, and that's why they're called irrational and imaginary, because because it was irrational to them.
Sure.
And that carried on to modern day, even though they like to call them complex numbers now instead of calling them irrational, but just because that makes more sense.
Yeah.
Or same with imaginary numbers. I'm like, they're not technically imaginary, it's just hard to express them outside of using I.
Yeah.
So, like, it's just interesting how and these were considered these Pythagoreans are considered like the pinnacle of scientific community at the time, which is kind of funny how illogical they would behave just to try and suppress something that they didn't believe in.
Sure.
But
I digress. What else about Galileo do you think is important that we should gloss over really quickly and then move on?
Unfortunately, there's just too much to cover.
I know, there is, and we're looking. Yeah. I look forward to later episodes when we get in deeper into these topics.
Yeah, this is just the broad strokes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anything, Galileo?
No, I don't have anything to add to it.
It's a cool mission named after him.
Galileo? Oh, yeah, okay. I was like, I was trying to think of what you were talking about for a second.
Right.
Then we move on to, what was Galileo's, do you know his dates, by the way?
Oh, I don't. Let me see. I didn't look that up.
Because we got to go to Kepler next, and they're around the same time, or at least same time relatively.
Hold on one second. I will. So 77. That's how he lived to an age of 77. 1564 to 1642.
Okay. It was in 1615 when he first concluded the heliocentrism of the solar system, again with Copernican's work before him. So then we move on to Johannes Kepler, a German mathematician, astronomer, and astrologer. He was also another key figure in what is known as the scientific revolution. You know, it was in the 17th century. And he is best known for coming up with the laws of planetary motion, as well as being some of the basis for what Isaac Newton's work would be when he came around.
Yeah.
What was? Do you know what his lifespan years were and all that stuff?
Kepler?
Yeah.
He lived from 1571 to 1630, so he only lived to 58.
Yeah, and he died before Galileo.
Yes, yeah.
You know what's funny? This happened, we've also got a biology episode coming up, and that happened with Gregor Mendel and with Charles Darwin. They together, like these guys, Galileo and Kepler are responsible for a lot of what we know today about planetary motion and our solar system, right? Mm. The same thing happened with Darwin and Mendel when it comes to the theory of evolution.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's a nice little coincidence. That's right. Very interesting, Josh. I digress.
I think it's interesting with Galileo and Kepler. What they decided to spend their time researching ended up being really beneficial for us, because when they were looking through Galileo's journals, they found that he had been testing acceleration and gravitation with marbles, and he has research pertaining to universal gravitation. But at one point during his journal, he's like, I think that it's not important for me to be researching gravitation, or like the force that moves these bodies.
So Kepler is the one that does it.
And yeah, exactly.
Two countries away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice. But they were both on to something there, but Galileo was like, I got more important shit to do.
Right.
Like, apparently.
This telescope over here is calling my name. I just.
But one of these geniuses end up having like this weird period where they're either forced to stop their scientific pursuits, and just think of what more Galileo could have discovered if he wasn't, you know, suppressed essentially.
For sure, yeah. From here, from Kepler and Galileo in the 17th century, we actually enter a new age of enlightenment in the world of Cambridge, and through a man named Sir Isaac Newton. Well, he was knighted posthumously, wasn't he?
Yes, he was.
Yeah. I mean,
though he was still famous during his living years.
There's no one in the world of physics, of mathematics, of pretty much any basis in science outside of, like, I guess biology, that Newton is not known and touted for.
Mm-hmm.
He's like the father of modern
Newtonian
science.
Physics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This guy, Peter, you probably know more about him than any of us, having studied a little bit about Newton. Why don't you drop it like it's hot?
Choo choo!
Here comes the debase.
Isaac Newton, born in 1643, started out as a really poor farmer. I can't do it, though. I have no lyrical genius whatsoever.
It's okay. I can't do beatboxing.
While he was a farmer, he actually had zero interest in being a farmer, like, so much so that the local municipality, I'll call it, kept fining him because he wouldn't repair his fence, and his sheep kept eating the
other people's stuff. Yeah.
And so once his family found out that he didn't have any interest in it, because he was more interested in making water clocks than actually farming, his family paid for him to go to the University of Cambridge. But while at Cambridge, they kind of had these three sects of students. They had this really low class student that essentially was the bitch boy, like the Maesters, actually. Maybe that's where he got it. It was from University of Cambridge, but like he had to go clean the shit pots in the rooms of all of the wealthier students, and that's how he kind of paid his tuition, because his family disowned him because his real father died and his mother remarried, and so she forsook him so that, like, all of her dowry would go to his children instead of Isaac Newton.
Sure.
And so they wouldn't give him any more money. So
that's a thing, like, the class system in Europe was still a major thing over there, and was until, I don't know, like the 1800s, 1900s, especially in England.
But
sorry.
No problem. No, it's totally true. Eventually, Newton got a professorship at Cambridge once it was discovered that he had taught himself trigonometry and geometry from the original publications, which are all mostly in Greek. So he had to teach himself language And actually, he had this Rubbage journal, which I'm just going to kind of touch on, where he put all of his axioms for, like, for the laws of motion and stuff before he actually published his paper. In there, he created his own cipher, which was this universal, like, he invented a universal language based off all of the languages that he had learned. And he's like, if the whole world spoke this, it would be great, essentially. But he never ended up publishing it. But eventually, the plague started spreading through Europe, and the University of Cambridge was closed. He was forced to go move back into the country with his family. But this is actually was a really good thing for humanity, because he stopped learning what was known and started looking at the unknown. And at that point, when he stopped learning the known, is when we started getting all of his best work.
Right.
Celestial motion. And
yeah.
All that
so
stuff,
he was obsessed with this stuff. So much so that he invented or possibly rediscovered a new form of mathematics in order to understand the motion of celestial bodies.
Calculus.
Yes, calculus. But and then he published his findings in this big book. I'm going to try and say this. The Philosophica Naturalis Principia. What is it?
Principia
Mathematica, which is the mathematical principles of natural philosophy, which is a really weird way of putting that whole thing.
Yeah.
But well, everything back then was still considered philosophy to the Royal Society, which he was a member of. But he summed up all that was known about mathematics, which at that time you couldn't do. You had to go back and read math from, you know,
from
Greek books.
Yeah,
exactly. And relearn that. So he put it all, he condensed it all together, and then he introduced his new calculus branch of mathematics, which revolutionized everything.
Well, yeah, it's another way of expressing the things that they were trying to express. Of course, it was revolutionary. You know, like, that's like when moving pictures happened.
Mm-hmm.
People had a new way of expressing themselves. Of course it's revolutionary. You know what I
that
mean?
That was like, more precise than the last.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's exactly what I'm talking about. Yeah.
And his infinitesimal calculus was so precise that it was he used that to express the relationship between gravitational bodies. And because before that, gravitation was theorized, but it was just like it was a distinct sphere. Like, if you were outside the sphere of influence, the body no longer had any effect on from the gravity of the planet that it was inside the sphere of influence. But he was the first to go, like, it's actually a relationship. The further away you are, the weaker it becomes. Mm. And he used his infinitesimal calculus and derivatives and integrals to prove that was the case.
Yeah.
But
we still use those to go to space.
Yeah,
absolutely.
To land Curiosity on Mars. Or,
and there's very little revision to his model of the universe.
Where it's supposed to go.
Point Voyager. I was trying to remember the Pluto.
Voyager 2? Oh, God.
New Horizons.
New Horizons.
Yeah, like to get New Horizons all the way out there. And you know, the so many years that it flew through space.
And to predict where Pluto would be.
Right, exactly. Yeah. That's all Newtonian gravity that we did that with.
This is as far back as 1687.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what is it? Galileo died in 1635. So 50 years later, Newton had everything.
Mm-hmm.
He had it ready, and that's amazing. Just to think about like that level of genius, I could say now I'll never do that. I mean, I might be able to.
They predict
his
IQ to be around 195.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So he was actually smarter than Einstein.
Yeah.
But he too had to build off of what was already known. I mean, mm-hmm. past scientists like that, all of that foundation work he needed to get as far as he did to make the laws of motion and gravitation. But in order to observe what he had discovered, he more or less pushed optics far past what anyone at the time knew about optics. I mean, he published a book called Optics with a K. I'm assuming that's Latin.
That or it's an old British thing.
That could be an old British
thing. Like how color has a U in it.
Oh, God, it does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And behavior, mm-hmm. actually, in England is different than behavior here. So I know.
Yep.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, but he discovered he was able to discover all the different component colors and how they were mixed together to create white light. And then
he had the first prism, didn't he?
He created one of the first prisms. Although lenses on sideways back then could be used to make
prisms. Okay.
But he was the first to make a parabolic mirror and put it in a telescope and catch more surface area light for his telescope than any telescope before it. And so using
a convex.
Yeah,
yeah. Okay,
and so it had this conic parabolic shape down to
and it would catch the light and it would reflect that to another mirror and then to a lens. But that it collected more light than all the refraction-based telescopes at the time, which is just incredible. I mean, he pushed us so far ahead in just that one way. And that was just him idly going like, oh, I invented calculus and I predicted the motion of planets. I want to go see if I'm right.
Yeah.
And so he like made this telescope to see if he was right. And voila. He did some other stuff. I mean, outside of mathematics, he was he decided that he was going to work for
the
king.
Yep. Yeah.
And became, what was it called? I've got it written.
Warden of the Royal Mint.
Warden of the Royal Mint. I've never, I wonder if that's still a thing. But
you
he,
think it was milk chocolate or?
Mint.
Evergreen?
Mint.
Wintergreen? No. That means money, folks.
Minting
mint.
The English coin.
He created a better coin using better metal and different alloys and different smelting techniques. He created the perfect coin that was.
That was his name?
Yeah, quote unquote, hardest to counterfeit. So right. Most of today's English pounds, hay pennies, or whatever they use over there that aren't paper money is based still on his perfect coin.
And he actually recalled all of the English currency at the time and melted it down and made new coins with
it. Imagine how pissed your populace would be for like a month.
Yeah.
You'll get all your money back. You'll get all your – just give it now.
I can't even think of the logistics of that. Like, businesses are going to have to give their money and then trade the money for new money.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, you can't go down to the individual, like, Josh, give me your money. I'll promise I pay you back. Yeah, like, no. I'm like, no. Sorry. Back when banking was kind of wishy-washy.
Back when?
Yeah, right.
I mean, shush. Forget that I ever said that.
Are we talking about just 2008? Or
we're talking about 2016, maybe 2017?
Gotcha.
But he ended up dying famous, wealthy, in Parliament, and president of the Royal Society.
Yeah. We will spend an episode for sure on
Newton. Absolutely. He's so important to even our culture nowadays.
Yeah.
So,
But let's move on to another member of the
astronomers. Did we ever say how long Newton lived?
No.
He's 84 years.
Okay, so the 70 rules out.
From 1642 to 1726/27.
Nice. Next on our list, we're going to jump ahead into the 18th century. William Herschel, he constructed the first large telescope. Like, when you think of observatories, this is the guy that made, like, the first observatory telescope. And it was still 2 years before the American Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy's German? Herschel's a German name. So either he was in America or he was a German astronomer. But this guy was able to – basically, he built upon – just like the scientists before him built upon the scientists before them, he built upon Newtonian physics and Newtonian ways of doing things and made a massive telescope. Mm-hmm. Awesome.
Yes, he was German, according to his Wikipedia page. And he lived to be 83, so 1738 to 1822.
So plus or minus 15 is where we're at, right? Or 70. So the theory could still be a thing. I'm gonna hold on to it for as long as I can.
He also created temperature measuring equipment that allowed him to determine the different spectra of light as far as their heating/cooling natures. The difference in the wavelengths is what I'm getting at.
Right, okay.
Like, blue wavelength is shorter, but red wavelength is longer, and determining how that light is either moving further or closer to us.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's a very horrible way to describe it.
The redshift? Redshift?
Yeah. Like color shift or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Colors always shift further into the red spectrum. So
that's
how you can tell how fast they're moving.
Yeah.
And how far away they've moved.
So. We have a telescope named after him, but we're going to go with Edwin Hubble. This guy is an American astronomer. He played a crucial role in establishing extragalactic astronomy and observational cosmology. He's regarded as one of the most important astronomers of all time. This guy was the one that like decided to start calling the clouds of gas and particles in the space nebulas.
Mm-hmm. Good name.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously most well-known for his name on the best space telescope in use so far.
Right.
Good. Yeah.
Distinction.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, considering we're about to put a different one up there.
Yeah. James Webb. All the way.
I'm so fucking pumped to see pictures from that thing.
No kidding, right? Like, you're like, is it still on its way or is it there? Is it on its way? Is it there? Okay, give me pics. Come on. Pixar didn't happen.
Hubble also did a lot of work with like the Big Bang model and the expansion of the universe too.
Yeah. So we spent a lot of time on Newton here, but we'll spend time on all of these guys and more. I mean, we didn't even talk about Einstein, who definitely had affected space and astronomy.
Yeah.
And special relativity, black holes.
Talk about building on top of what other people have done. I mean, he pushed what Newton had made and created an even greater and more accurate model of the universe.
Yeah. We should mention Stephen Hawking. I think we'd be remiss not to mention him.
Absolutely, yeah. His work with black holes and Hawking radiation.
And we can definitely mention, Carl Sagan, as a scientist himself, did a lot of work with Venus that we should mention. Neil deGrasse Tyson is still doing research in astrophysics, so there's no reason not to talk about him as well.
Absolutely. There's so many people we could be talking about. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of wind around towards the back half of this episode, Adam, why don't you take us away into what is most exciting to you about astronomy, astrophysics, and
most exciting to me? Well, I don't know. I love most of it.
I love lots of stuff.
Whereas we've been going a lot over history, I'm also very into like futurology and stuff, and where the universe is going, things like that are extremely interesting to me. Colonization, we've talked, we will talk about, I guess, like space-time, fabric of space-time, bending space-time.
Mm-hmm. The shape of the universe, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. And made some theories of like what the universe is made out of. What is the fabric of space time?
Also, you know, dark matter. What is that?
Dark matter, dark energy. Exactly. Yeah. We will definitely have a whole episode on dark matter and dark energy, I would think, because there's a lot of that could lead to some good discussion.
And the expansion and compression of the universe.
Absolutely.
Omega. Yeah.
I like the Flat Earth Society. I think that's a great thing. I like that most people think that we're still a geocentric part of the cosmos. I love the ignorance around astronomy. As far as from my perspective, like we covered a lot of the stuff that I like about history. There's nothing cooler to me than learning about the people that broke the bonds and questioned the natural way of things and showed that, oh, this is actually how it is, as opposed to accepting what they're told from an institution, from the people that came before them, whatever.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of my favorite things about science in general, is just mm-hmm. the breaking through of barriers. Another one of the things that I like about astronomy is Carl Sagan calls it the science of humility. Then famously spoke in about a 3-minute space about it in Pale Blue Dot. We are a speck on a mote of dust suspended in a sunbeam. There's nothing special about humanity, and the way to show that is the size and scope of the universe.
Mm. Makes you more unique
yeah.
and insignificant simultaneously.
I would say more insignificant, which is fine because I felt insignificant for the most of my life.
Well, I mean, in Carl Sagan's book Cosmos, he talks about that insignificance, but he also talks about how he goes over the mathematics and probability of finding other
life
in the universe. And then he ends up coming up with this equation or illustrating a known equation.
Yeah.
And honestly, it makes you feel insignificant, but at the same time, really special to know how rare life is in general.
From as far as we can tell, absolutely.
And the last thing that I really enjoy about astronomy is the romanticism that we attach to it as humans.
Mm-hmm.
On Waiting for Players, we spent a lot of time talking about the Juno mission and how in ancient Greece, Juno was the wife of Jupiter
mm-hmm.
and was the only one who could peer through the clouds to see what Jupiter was doing with his mistresses. The mission to Juno is going to Jupiter and surveying Jupiter and its moons, and the moons are all named after Jupiter's actual mm-hmm. mistresses.
Yeah.
But just beyond that, the way we name celestial bodies, the way that we consider ourselves as on Earth or Terra, and that the king of the planets is Jupiter, of course, and he's the king of the gods. Mm-hmm. Venus, the goddess of love, she's the one closest to us between us and the sun.
Yep.
Mercury, the messenger god, is the one who moves fastest around the sun but is rarely seen. And then Pluto, the god of the underworld, he's furthest out and not even a planet anymore. Go see yourself.
It's funny how like accurately that describes the behavior of celestial bodies without them actually knowing
for sure
what they were or how they were moving exactly. Yeah. So, and how accurate, I mean, it is, Jupiter is king of planets. Let's be real.
For real, right?
Absolutely. And that would be a fun thing to do too, go through the whole solar system.
Yeah.
Kind of take a closer look at. Yeah, exactly.
Especially with what we know from Cassini and and Juno right now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Especially with what we've seen coming
horizons
from
horizons.
Yeah. Yeah, with what we saw of Pluto and how it has a whale tail. I mean a heart.
We got some amazing pictures of Pluto. And still surprising
pictures. Well, I was remiss. So. This is episode 3. I called it episode 2. Oh well. My bad. Because we just talked to Steven last episode. What about you, Pete? What is enthralling to you about astronomy, the universe, and everything?
I think that I'm more interested in cosmology. I was reading a lot of Carl Sagan's book recently, and before that, I was reading a Carl Sagan's book, Contact. And unlike the film, there's actually this really cool. I don't really know what you would call it, but I don't really believe in God, but or a higher power, and that's something that I've kind of you always kind of struggle with when you've decided to be an atheist. That there's this almost like void, you know, where like there's meaning that's lost there. But in his book, he's talking about once they've met the aliens in the book Contact, they were like the main character. Was asking this alien, where do you guys find meaning? Like, what do you do? Where is your search? Because they're searching for alien life, and she wanted to know what they were looking for. Mm-hmm. And so then he said, if you calculate the digits of pi out to, you know,
a billion,
right. there'll be this code embedded inside the irregularity of pi. And what I thought was really interesting about that is that it's this kind of like, there's a creator, and the creator is going, leaving people breadcrumbs, like, sure. I am here, I created the universe. And so, and that's what these people are looking for. But then when you hear about, like, the cosmic background, like, the beginnings of time, then you realize what light actually is and how you perceive the universe through this, essentially, time traveling.
Through ghosts of light.
Yeah, and so it draws me in to cosmology because it makes me feel like, there is a connection between everything,
sure.
between me and those other things, and that it gives my life meaning because even though we're insignificant, we're also really important.
Yeah.
Like what we're capable of doing as humans and what we're a part of something, even if it's insignificant, that can carry on to the future and have huge impact on the universe.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Anything else you guys want to talk about as far as astronomy goes? Just for this first episode?
Nothing. No, I don't think we have anything else to add to this one. Just like we've said before.
I got one.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
As more and more and more as we go through the cosmos, and the more we learn about the cosmos, you're gonna get better science fiction.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Any scientist, any writer, fiction writer worth anything, and I'm thinking specifically of like the guy who wrote The Martian. He did his research first and then gave us a compelling story.
Yes.
Yeah.
So there's no reason why, as we break through in science, that you cannot popularize that through science fiction. And I think that's a goal that we should do moving forward.
And I want to support that point, actually, by saying, like, in animation, when we finally get to animation, like in the time of Walt Disney and stuff, they created rules of animation. And one of them was real but exaggerated.
Yep.
And so when you look at really smooth animations that are appealing to the eye, those animations are appealing because they are based off of something known. They're based off of like a spring, right? Off of these real physical objects.
Oh, okay.
And so something is more compelling, like fantasy or like science fiction, when it's based off of something real.
So another way to think of that is think of like a cartoon steak. That steak is probably the most delicious thing you've ever seen because it's based on the ideal schema of a steak.
Yeah.
Or how about this? You can also do it from sound effects wise. Think about it's a crude example, but think about when you hear someone urinating either over a speaker or like during a movie. Mm-hmm. That is the quintessential sound of someone urinating, not necessarily that they actually fully captured someone urinating.
Right. Yeah.
Right. So I like that. It's a good analogy.
Yeah. It brings something to it by taking something that's real and fascinating about the real universe and tweaking it, and now it's science fiction, now it's fantasy.
But
and
it's
sometimes
still
that's predictive, funny enough.
But it's still adhering to that schema. That
yeah, absolutely.
That
the purely abstract stake or the purely abstract animation. But I feel like if you like Star Trek, right? There's a lot that's based in science, and then they just take it a little further, and then there's all the pseudoscience surrounding it, but it always makes it feel more real and more compelling.
I have a communicator. We all do. I think we all have a communicator.
A tricorder right here.
Yeah, it's a scanner. It's a it's a camera. It's a phone.
It's got a lot of sensors on it. It's got a barometer.
In the World's Fair, this was science fiction.
Right.
At the 1939 World's Fair, this was fake.
Mm-hmm. Headphones, science fiction.
Yeah. Now it's
1984. Now it's real.
It's absolutely real. So there's no reason that science cannot be popularized, especially when you think of it as interesting as it actually is.
Yeah.
With that, we'll be covering biology next. No, wait. We got one more astronomy one that we're gonna get through next, and then we'll be doing some biology next time. So for Science Nights this week, bye.
Thank you.
Goodbye.